Welcome to Garden DC, the podcast about everything gardening in the Washington, D.C. and Mid-Atlantic region. I'm your host, Kathy Gents. I'm the editor of Washington Gardener magazine, and we're aimed at gardening enthusiasts, people who grow everything from edibles to ornamentals, natives to exotics. If it grows in our area, that's what we talk about. This week on the Garden DC podcast, I'm joined by Sean and Allison of Spoken Garden. They're garden teachers with YouTube videos. They have their own podcast, and they are also recent authors. Welcome, Sean and Allison.
Hey, thanks, Kathy.
We're happy to be here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for both of you joining me, and I neglected to say that you are not from the Mid-Atlantic like most of the guests that we interview on the Garden DC podcast. You are from the PNW, not the DMV.
Yeah.
And that's Washington.
Other Washington. So that's the Pacific Northwest, and we're going to call it the Left Coast or the Other Washington or Washington State. So we're going to call this a crossover episode. So like that very special, you know, 70s sitcom, like when Laverne and Shirley came on Happy Days.
Oh, yeah.
And that doesn't date us at all, right?
No.
Or how about, here's another one to totally date us. How about when the Love Boat cast or Fantasy Island would cross over? That's a big crossover.
Oh,
right.
Oh, that was big. That was huge.
That was huge. Yeah. So we're talking Washington versus Washington. So we'll talk all gardening and comparing and contrasting our totally different regions, what we have in common, and a few things that we don't have in common.
Yes, it's going to be fun.
It's going to be great.
First, Sean and Allison, tell me how you both got into gardening. Were you born with green thumbs, with chlorophyll in your veins, or how did you come about to the gardening bug?
Great question. Well, we both have such different stories to tell. For me, I was always a science nerd growing up, and I grew up with parents that just always kind of had me doing something in the yard, you know, weeding or picking that up or doing this, moving that. So I kind of, you know, at the time I was like, oh, I don't want to do that. I want to go play. But in later years, I realized how much I enjoyed being outside and around plants and flowers. And it just kind of led to my love of science, which led me to become a science teacher, which I was a middle school science teacher for about, 13 years. And I recently left that profession to start our business.
Yeah, I started off in gardening, I guess, when I was about 5 years old. My parents, they opened up, they bought some land and started a rhododendron farm out towards about 30 or so minutes away from where we currently live right now, but out in Olympia. And so at 5 years old, I was taking cuttings, I was dipping and sticking, I was mixing soil, building greenhouses alongside my dad, my brother, and yeah, just kind of went from there.
Wow. So, but very different backgrounds, but totally plant immersed.
Oh, yeah.
And so, Allison, your middle school science teacher plant background, were you using botany in the classroom? Did you have access to any planting areas or a school garden?
You know, I love that question because I really didn't. I actually taught more about earth science and different chemistry and unfortunately, I taught eighth grade and the sixth grade curriculum was more botany based. And so I would always go down there and bother them. And what are you guys doing down here? You know, what are your labs today? So I kind of got my fill there. We actually did have a very small school garden at our first location, but then our whole building moved and we didn't have another location set up yet. So I hope that's in the works for them, you know, at this point. But yeah, it was kind of hard to organize that and get that rolling out. But I hope they're able to do that.
Yeah, it would be nice if every school had a garden or at least access to a garden.
Yeah, absolutely. It's such a great learning environment and experience.
And it gets kids outside.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Although middle school, I don't know about you, Allison, but I find that a tough age.
It was absolutely. It was always fun when we went to big staff meetings with other schools. They'd be like, oh, you guys are the middle school teachers, you know. we always kind of had a different view on things, because that was actually the age group I chose to work with. And that was my least favorite years of school. So it's funny how you, you know, kind of change your mind on that. They were just so much fun and awkward and funny. And I think if anything, I would have maybe moved up to ninth grade in high school to teach if I would have stayed. But I loved teaching eighth grade. It was fun.
Hmm. Yeah, it's that awkward age, but also full of leaps and bounds, you know. And you can so kind of make some comparisons to the garden that way too.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. And there's those plants that are in that awkward stage, maybe in their second year of growth, and you're like, come on.
<It's> so close.
Yes. And then other plants might take off on you and exceed their expectations in their second year. But then by the third year, pretty much everybody's caught up with each other.
Oh, that's fun. I like that.
That's a good way to look at it.
Mm-hmm. So let's talk a little bit about Washington State versus the Mid-Atlantic, Washington, D.C. So you're on a coast as well, and you're in Spokane, Washington, which is on which side? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Actually, we're on the Seattle side. We're down south.
Yeah, on the Seattle side. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know why I thought Spokane and Spokane.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I can see that. That happens every once in a while. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Okay. So you're on the Seattle side. So you're on the left side of the mountains, am I correct?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, and so that's a totally different climate than the other part of Washington.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. We have a maritime climate here. It's been referred to as also a Mediterranean climate. Hmm. And, you know, we're actually in our location where we live, and even Seattle, we're at least 2 hours away from the actual coastline of Washington State. But because of what we have here called Puget Sound, it's an inlet area of the actual ocean, and it comes really far inland, and it's seawater, it's saltwater. Mm. It comes all the way in from the Pacific Ocean. And because of that body of water and all the islands and even our peninsula, we have such an amazing maritime climate here. And it's great.
It's amazing. It's very mild.
Yes.
It's a very mild climate.
Nice. And I think that has a lot of parallels here to Washington, D.C., where you have the huge Chesapeake Bay coming in. And on both sides of the city, you have the Potomac River and the Anacostia converging into the Chesapeake. And the Chesapeake is brackish waters, as it's described. And it's very shallow bay. I mean, there's miles of it almost, you know, that you could stand up in. So it's very, very shallow parts of it that it seems like it's deep, but it's not actually deep at all. Mm-hmm. And so, and the city itself of DC is pretty similar and distant to the coastline. So if you were go to the eastern shore, it would be about 90 minutes, depending on how you drove and which way you went. So similar inland with, you know, a big body of water kind of protecting you there. And it's been described here as a temperate rainforest. And I know that's also been applied to the Pacific Northwest sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Similar.
It's very interesting. Yeah. We've got our Olympic National Rainforest out here. We've also got the start of the Pacific, or not Pacific, but a coastal range that actually is before the Cascade Range that's closer to the ocean. And it basically starts up in the peninsula of Washington State, and it runs all the way down into Oregon and parts of California. And so we have like a mini range from the coast that comes in, and then that stops, and then you get into the lowlands and where we live, and then there's the Cascade Range.
Kind of sandwiched between two mountain ranges.
Yeah.
It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's probably the major difference is we have the Appalachian Mountains and, you know, they're basically your foothills. So they're not stopping big weather fronts really from coming to their side. There's some weather patterns that might go around, you know, or be slowed down a bit. But in comparison to being, you know, fitting between the mountains and the sea, that's a little bit different there.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I know that there's so many transplants from the Midwest to the Mid-Atlantic, to Washington, D.C., and New York, and New Jersey, and Pennsylvania for jobs. And I always hear that one of their first remarks is how hilly it is. how the topography it is. Huh. And, you know, there's lots of stream valleys. There's lots of gentle, to me, hills and dales type of topography. But I don't know if you ever did this, you guys, as kids, but did your dad ever speed up the car when you're going on a country drive to catch wind going over a hill?
Totally.
Yeah.
I remember that. I remember that too.
So you can do that a lot here in suburban and countryside outside of Washington, D.C., in both Maryland and Virginia. So we used to call them, when we were little, we would say wee hills, because we would yell wee. We would be like, here comes the wee hill. And then we would yell wee. We would catch air. So I think that's something that's different than the middle of the country in the Midwest. But you have different hillsides or topography there.
Yeah, we've got some gentle slopes. We've also got some very steep slopes, and there's lots, like where we live right now, it's a gentler type of sloped area, but we live on top of kind of a plateau before you go down into what we call the Puyallup Valley, or just the valley on the east side of us, and that's really low. But where we live on a kind of a plateau, we have our little peaks and valleys, and we live actually down in a lower area. We get a lot of cooler air trapped down in our neighborhood versus like a couple neighborhoods over. They're up a little bit higher and they don't have anything like we have like that.
Yeah.
I was going to say, Sean, that's a great point, because every neighborhood, every backyard, even versus your front yard, there's lots of little different temperate zones or colder zones. So I've noticed that near us, there's a public garden, Brookside Gardens, and they're up in Wheaton Park, just north of Washington, D.C. And it's almost like 10 degrees cooler when you go down into their gardens versus at my house on the DC border. So it's remarkable with the topography there and that stream valley, and just going, a few feet downhill, mm-hmm. it seems can make that difference.
Oh, yeah.
And here we have the coastal plain versus Piedmont regions. Hmm. And if you've ever been on the East Coast and you've been on I-95 in the Washington, D.C. area, that almost perfectly divides the coastal plain region, the flat plateau that goes out to the bay and to the sea, versus the Piedmont, which is the hilly side of 95.
Cool. Wow. Yeah.
And really, I was going to say, a lot of native plants are classified with one of those regions or the other. Either they're native to the coastal plain or the Piedmont. Not, there's some overlap between, obviously, one side of I-95 to another. You can throw some seeds on either side. But it's more sandier soil versus more clay soil, a little bit more elevation, a little bit more moisture on one side than the other. Mm-hmm. And what's between it is called the fall line. And that's where Great Falls is located, and there is a sharp actual fall line in some of the topography, and I believe it was created, and hopefully some geologists can maybe correct me here, by one of the ice age glacier lines where it just broke right there. So on the Potomac River, you can see the fall line very abruptly. You can see it in some of our local parks. And it's a remarkable, when you go for a 20-minute walk from one side of the fall line to the other, just the entire collection of plants is so different from one side to the other.
Oh, that's cool.
That's so cool. Right, I know, we're totally loving this.
Yeah. No, that's great. And Kathy, we see something kind of similar to that with plant life and such from mountain range to mountain range, like we were talking about the mountain ranges before in the hills. Our Puget Sound, it was completely cut out by a huge glacier millions of years ago, right? So, because of that, the Puget Sound has very deep areas, and it has very abrupt edges to the islands themselves. And then other places, it's like you were talking about your river out there. It's shallow in a lot of areas too, so it's so different and creates so many different microclimates.
It really
it's fun.
Yeah, different plants and whatnot, different types of gardens around the area, different things. That's cool.
And I noticed I was looking at some of the geology of the fall line, some of it could have more limey type rocks, more acidic soil, more alkaline. What is your general soil makeup in the Pacific Northwest, or does it vary?
It varies from area to area. It's kind of crazy because you can go from up north, up in like the valley area up there, and they'll have a lot of silt and a lot of sediment, a lot of valley soil, and even some clay. And then you come down in our area and there's still clay, but then there's a good amount of sand. And, you know, the Pacific Northwest, a lot of people say, well, it's a lot of clay soil out there. It's real acidic. And it's like, well, in general, yeah. But when you start looking at it in the different areas, no, there are some differences.
And when you say clay, because we're cursed with clay here, but also blessed with it, we're talking super heavy, you know, orange, yellow layers of clay, depending on, you know, what side of the fall line are and where you're at. Mm-hmm. But of course, clay is great because it holds nutrients and it holds moisture, but it's also bad because it can cause rotting of roots and retain a bit too much moisture. Mm-hmm. It's always one of those grass is always greener type of things. You want sandier soil, you want loamier soil, and, you know, just have to keep on amending. So our favorite type of amendment or top dressing or mulching here in the Mid-Atlantic is leaf mulch, so shredded leaves, just layered and partially decayed. Do you use similar?
Yeah, we'll use a mix of things.
I know,
too.
A lot of different things.
And it kind of depends on what you're trying to do. Like you were saying, you know, that leaf material, it makes a lot more pore space. It adds nutrients into the soil. It does a lot of great things for the soil. What we try to do is we mix the leaf material in with also a lot more organic matter. And like, you know, compost or other types of even manure or something, just to give it that boost of nutrients. But I mean, we use wood chips.
We love wood chips.
Yeah, like
and there's some pine needles around too. We don't have too many in our yard though, right?
Yeah.
But that's kind of
the fir needles, pine needles. I mean, it's almost around here. Sometimes it's like, what do you got next to you? What do you got near you? And just grab it, and it'll help the clay soils at some at some level. But yeah, it's. It can be very interesting, but yeah, I mean, we usually try to use compost in our garden, and we'll use the compost, mix that into the soil, because our soil is really, it's a lot more, it's like at least 50% sand over and above the clay and even just the silt. And then we'll mix in the compost to get that soil built up, to give it the structure. And then we'll lay down when the leaves drop in the fall, we'll lay those over the top. And then on top of that, we'll let those rot. And we'll take arborist mulch and we'll put that over the top of the leaves. So we have multiple layers of different organic matter just really starting to break down and help our soil.
Mm-hmm. And arborist mulch, we should define that for our listeners. And that's something that's becoming trendy now, and with gardeners, and lots of new studies are coming out about wood chip or arborist chips, sometimes it's called, and that's beginning to be used a lot more in the Mid-Atlantic as well.
Oh, good. Yeah, it's, you know, it's a great way to recycle some of the trees that come down, and it's kind of fun too, because some people say, well, you should use arborist mulch, or you should use, you know, something like this. It's like, well, arborist mulch, it has multiple different sources. And, you know, it can be from a juniper tree, it could be from a cedar, it could be from a maple or even an oak. And depending where you get it from, it's going to have slightly different properties. And it's kind of fun because it can have different smells, different textures. And
different colors.
Yeah, different colors. Some of it will last a lot longer than others, too. So it can be a big mix of whatever's available.
Mm-hmm. And in past, we were advised not to use wood chips around our shrubs and things because it could introduce diseases that were, say, in the trees or the shrubs that were taken down, or some type of insect, you know, predation or something could be transferred. And also that, and this was maybe disproven recently, that it would take up nitrogen from the soil as the chips are decaying.
Yep.
But if you think about it, that nitrogen has to go back somewhere as the chips are decaying. So they were saying it was taking it up, binding it, and not letting the plants use up that nitrogen as the chips were breaking down.
Mm-hmm. I know. When I was going through school, I came across that too. There was a whole bunch of studies on it, and all the soil scientists were up in arms. And then you had the guys in forestry, like, you know, taking the opposite opinion on it. It's like, come on, guys, you know, this is so complicated. let's just, everybody just calm down. So, but it was, yeah, it's an interesting topic. And to get into the meat of it, I mean, it's like, you got to look at, you know, at the molecular level, what's going on, what's binding to what, and how's that really, you know, how's that happening? And then how's the environment, you know, influencing that with the temperatures and moisture? I mean, it gets so complicated so quick. So,
Yeah. And I just would advise anybody who's getting wood chips delivered or picking them up, say, from a municipal site or a county site, just wear your gloves because poison ivy. Yes. That's the biggest precaution, I would say, is wear long sleeves and gloves because, you know, taking down some of those large old trees, they're just chipping everything. Mm-hmm. They're not, you know, going to sit there and sort out the poison ivy vines. And think about what, you know, if a tree came down at the back of a property, you know, old property, it, you know, chances are pretty good there's some poison ivy mixed in there.
You know, and for us too, Kathy, we haven't really run into any poison ivy per se, but English ivy out here is so invasive. And mm-hmm. when we get our arborist mulch, that's the one thing we're looking for, is that English ivy remnants, you know, the leaves and those thick stems and roots. And we really keep an eye out for that because we don't want that to get started in our garden. We already ripped it all out.
We have so much.
Yeah. Same here. We have abundant English ivy taking mm-hmm. over many areas. And yeah, you don't want to reintroduce it back into your garden trying to do amendments. So maybe filter the wood chips a little, or just know your source is another good thing to know.
Totally. Definitely.
Oh yeah.
So let's talk about day length and sunlight between the two different Washingtons.
Yeah. Oh, cool.
So I was looking up in Washington, D.C., our shortest day of the year, December 21st, is we have 9 hours and 26 minutes of daylight. And our longest day of the year, we have 14 hours and 54 minutes on June 20th. And so that's a variation of about 4.5-5 hours difference from longest to shortest. And do you have the day lengths for your region, or do you have a feel for that?
Right now we have a feel for it. Allison's typing it up to see if we can.
Yeah. Well, our current, like today's like daylight today, we're at about 14 and a half hours of daylight. Mm-hmm. So it's, we're losing about 3 minutes a day. It looks like.
I think in general, our longest day length around here is usually around 16 hours.
Wow.
Yeah, it can sometimes it's like almost 10 o'clock and it's still daylight out and you're thinking, what's going on? Mm-hmm. So, but yeah, it's it can stay light for a long time. We were talking about this the other day. We're really happy that the day lengths are starting to get a little bit shorter, because it's just sometimes it's nice for our sleep patterns to not have that day length go on for so long. So, but let's see. Allison's pulling it up here.
I know we didn't have that fact ready, but it looks like it's
worries.
About 7.5 hours is the difference, it looks like, between summer solstice to December solstice or winter solstice. Okay. So that's interesting. So
yeah, that's a big range.
That's really because
you're a bit north of us. The map. And so we're on, I think we're like the 38th, 39th. Parallel, and I'll have to look up Washington is 47.
47.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep.
That's a big difference. So
we were talking about that earlier too. It's so interesting that we are on a more northern parallel, but our zone is one higher than yours. You know, we're zone 8 versus 7. So it's just so interesting how the topography influences that.
Yeah. The only thing we can think of is partially the Puget Sound and that water, that body of water really helps keep our climate a lot milder.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. And the your mountain range that's protecting you and keeping that in, and then the warm coastal waters. So together, so we have the warm coastal waters here, but we don't have such a protective mountain range, which is good and bad, because if it held in more of this humidity, I can't imagine any more than we already have being blocked in. But yeah, and it just shows you that just because you're north or south of a location doesn't mean that your growing zone is higher or lower necessarily. So as you said, you guys are zone 8. We have touches of zone 8 in the area, and we're certainly getting more and more towards zone 8. Most of us are in the heart of zone 7 and at higher elevation zone 6. But you know, with climate change coming, we can feel it. You know, you can definitely feel that we're almost tending to have zone 8 winters lately.
And isn't that interesting? You know, wow. We have been wondering about that. Our climate has been so different lately here. Our winters have been a lot warmer. We've had plants live over into December and January that normally wouldn't have. It's so interesting.
And then some of our winters too, at the tail end of the winter, we get a whole bunch of snow right at the end, where in most recent years up to this point, we haven't. It's been just mild. It's been wet. It's been really cold, but not freezing enough to turn all the rain into snow. But the last 2 or 3 years, we've gotten almost at least a foot and a half to two snow every February. And it's like, wow, that's new.
Wow. So you actually had to invest in some snow shovels.
Boot shovels.
What are those?
Yeah. Here in the DC area, it's more of a freeze and ice storm could be more of the problem. And that's a huge issue for breakage of plants and problems. So it could freeze overnight. And of course, public safety and, you know, just safety walking or driving on ice. And then, you know, usually in the winter, we'll get 2 inches one day and then it's melted the next day. And then you could get 6 inches at the beginning of February and then it melts 2 days later. So it's just kind of like wait a couple days and the weather has changed. And then you get the occasional northeasters where you get 3 feet dumped on you in one day. And that's usually, I'm going to say, every 6 to 10 years we get an event like that. And then you're kind of socked in for a week or so. And that's highly unusual for us just to have a blanket on the ground of, you know, something that would weigh down actual trees or anything like that. So it's kind of, you know, we have a very freeze thaw winter time. And that can be tough on some plants. And that's, I think, what makes it a zone 7 winter still and not quite a zone 8 is I always use my pond as a good example, my little water garden. Because I have fish in there and they're supposed to survive and be on their own. I don't feed them. they're supposed to go to the bottom into the muck during the coldest part of the winter. But they're still all up there swimming up on the surface, having a good old time.
Wow. Oh, good.
And then I'll walk out one day in February and they're frozen in the first inch of the water. Everything below that is not frozen, but they just got caught really fast. And that's how fast the freeze comes overnight.
Wow.
And then it'll thaw out. And then I have these little popsicles floating there. And I'm like, it's your own fault, fishies. But yeah, they're not the smartest creatures. But, you know, one day it was 55 and the next day it was 20. So, you know, you can't really blame them for not being able to catch the weather patterns. And same thing in our gardens. It's like, do we cover this? Do we protect it? And most of us are like too busy to be on top and we just let things be exposed.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's like, yeah, well, we hope it makes it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you mentioned the fast freezing. Sometimes, Kathy, we'll get this really cold weather from up in BC in British Columbia, Canada, and it comes out of what's called the Fraser Valley, the Fraser River Valley, and it just sweeps down and we'll get a hard freeze and it'll get down and maybe to the teens, sometimes single digits, mostly like the 20s and teens. And that hasn't happened in a little while, but
it's very, very rare.
Every once in a while we'll get that, but it comes straight up from the north and or straight down from the north. And it's just, you get ready for it. And yeah, it's basically, well, we hope all the plants make
we'll
it.
See what happens in a few days. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And those are always like the asterisk years on the calendar where you're like, okay, that's the year that the blizzard happened or lake effect snow or your Fraser effect snow for you all. So we talked about length of sunlight and we talked about our soil mix and some of our weather and climate. So, and you touched on with the snowfall, we can talk about precipitation differences. So I think we generally have similar inches of precipitation total. It's just the pattern that they arrive in that's very different for us.
Yeah. So yeah, for us, we usually get a slow drizzle. We'll get a couple of storms that come in, but a lot of times we just get this weather, it just comes in and it kind of just hangs out and stays for a while.
Yeah.
And then it moves on through and then the next one moves and comes in. So it's kind of a steady slow rain most of the time.
But it is kind of a little bit of a secret around our area that a lot of people think, oh, Pacific Northwest, you guys just get dumped on all year. That's not the case. We really don't. I mean, we get maybe 30 to 40 inches of rain a year or something like that.
Something like that, yeah.
But it doesn't, I don't know. It's kind of like we do have drier summers. I mean, we just, it's kind of an like we already said, it's an interesting climate around here.
Yeah. There's an old saying regionally around here that the bluest skies are in Seattle. And that's because in the summertime, there's a lot of blue sky. There's it's actually sunnier than a lot of people think.
Yeah, it's quite in the rain shadow.
Anyway.
Yeah, so it's your winter into spring. That's obviously the wettest season.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And same for us. That's more of the moisture, but it's we get bigger rain events during the summer. So parts of our region last night got 5 inches. And then the day before that got 2 inches. Wow. So you have a lot of these hit or miss. So that could totally miss your zip code or totally miss by you. And then the next town over gets dumped on. So it's a lot of those, you know, infrequent, but lots of rain at once. So good use of rain barrels and drip emitters. Yep. And so we would love to have, I guess what it's called, a slow English rain, where it's just a nice, soft, drizzly rain all day long. That can happen for us in early spring or in the fall, but not normal for the summertime. So I looked up the DC average rainfall and per year, 43 plus inches.
Oh, wow.
Okay. And days of precipitation, 114. So, you know, every third day or so, you could get rain, basically, type of thing. So we're a bit over the U.S. average, which I'm sure if we're including the entire Western U.S., which is in drought now, that's, you know, that kind of skews the averages there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Allison just looked it up for us, and it says 145 days on average per year of precipitation for Tacoma.
I don't think this year it's been under average for that, below average.
Yeah, we're in part of the Western drought right now, but we haven't had the worst of it like the Midwest and parts of California and Arizona and that. So, but yeah, we're seeing a little bit of the drought this year.
Yeah, and our normal pattern is July, August, we can have about 6 weeks of just normal summer drought, except for those pop-up storms. Mm-hmm. So that's a normal pattern for us. Last summer, for 2020, we had actually a fairly wet summer, which was very unusual, and it really stressed out our oak trees and our old growth forests. So we saw a lot of disease in that, and that brings us to our next topic, which is foliar disease, if I can say that, and insects and other pests, and comparing the two Washingtons. And we know we have one big thing in common, and that's deer.
Oh, yeah.
I feel like we're lucky in that in our area, at least right here, we don't have a deer problem because we're so suburban, I think. Yeah. They're in the area, but we've never had actual damage, you know, from that. But a lot of our friends up north, they can't grow anything unless you put a big fence around it.
Yeah, really tall fences, really too, tall. Obviously. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we find there's so many stream valleys, and the way the suburban cul-de-sacs are built, you're creating the perfect environment for deer because it's all edge habitat. You know, you've got like little pockets of trees in between houses, and guess where deer like to live? Little pockets of trees in between in between clearings. So we're creating that perfect habitat both in the city and in the close-in suburbs, and of course out in the country. The difference in farther out is there's more for them to eat and more for them to explore, so it's a little less deer pressure. Although of course in the agricultural area you still get, you know, farmers dealing with deer coming in and eating corn crops and that sort of thing.
Oh yeah. Yeah. We see that in our area too, of course. And yeah, it's, they're such a beautiful animal, though. Sometimes we want to see them coming, but then we realize if we do see them coming, the damage they can do. So, but yeah, not in our area per se. Yeah. Not in our neighborhood, but just down the road, probably about a good mile or two, maybe 3 miles. There's a lot more.
Yeah, that's true. Mm-hmm.
Well, be vigilant because they are creatures of habit. And once a fawn is birthed in your landscape, they will keep coming back because they, mm-hmm. you know, they're familiar with it. You know, that's their little round. That's their little area. So one huge difference I was looking at, and I was like, this is kind of good in our favor, DC, is we have slugs.
Oh, you know,
they're like the size of a pinky, maybe at the most. And you might see a tiger slug and you turn over a rock or a brick or something at your garden edge and you're like, ugh. And, you know, you might have a little bit of chewing on some of your hostas, but I don't think anything compared to your slugs.
Oh,
yeah, we can grow some pretty big, mean ones up here.
We definitely have slugs and snails, but yep. mostly in our area, slugs for sure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they get over everything for us. I mean, it's amazing. How many, so we use a product called Sluggo, and how many cans of that do you think we've used so far?
Since spring?
Yeah.
Gosh, at least three.
Three or four.
Three, five, and
it's the big
cans.
Yeah, it's the big cans too.
And it does work. I mean, we've been like very impressed because, mm-hmm. I mean, they go after our hostas. I mean, they go after everything.
It's everything. Yeah. So, it doesn't really matter what we plant. They'll try everything out, and they'll see slug trails even over our roadies. And yeah, I mean, they just go everywhere.
Everywhere.
Fences. I mean, there's hordes of them.
Yeah, I can't. So for listeners, that's Sluggo with two G's and an O at the end. Kind of go. Like, oh, is that the character in Little Rascals? I don't know. If it's Sluggo. Yeah, right. So it's iron phosphate. So it is an organic additive. It's not going to do any harm to your plants or any other creatures. Just that a slug would digest it and then perish from that. And you would sprinkle it. It comes in like a big, looks like a Parmesan shaker canister.
Pretty much.
Which is what Sean was talking about. Yeah. So I have one that's probably 4 or 5 years old that still have. And I usually have to shake it around as the hostas just start to emerge in the spring. Then I'll, you know, right before the slugs are starting to chew on them. And then around my salad greens in our vegetable plot, I might occasionally have to do like a little ring around those just if I start to see a little bit of slug damage. And that's about it. Then that's usually it, springtime. And then that's about it for us.
That's not bad.
That sounds nice.
I mean, that's good for you.
Yeah, no, we still have to use it, especially in the wetter times of year, but also even in the summers. I mean, if we get if it's some cool weather that moves in and it's even a little bit wet, we see them. They pop up out of nowhere, it seems like. And it's just like, where have you guys been? Where do you hide? We got to get you. And it can be a real problem sometimes. Like last year, almost all summer, we saw them almost all summer long.
That was a different summer. Yeah. Not so much this summer. We have aphids everywhere.
Yeah.
We cannot seem to get rid of those.
This year is a great year for aphids.
I bet, yeah.
Yeah, same here. Lots of aphid issues. And one disease I was going to ask about is you can grow beautiful roses because you don't have as much black spot from the heat and humidity as we do in the Pacific Northwest. But do you have rose rosette? Are you familiar with that?
Kind of familiar. I think it's a virus. Yeah,
spread by mites. Yeah,
yeah.
I think it's
Oh, go ahead.
I was gonna say I think it's coming your way. I've heard a little bit of reports because I'm in the Rose Society, and so it's wind-borne mites that spread it. And so generally, it has stayed on the right side of the Mississippi and the Rockies. So generally you've pretty much been immune to it, but definitely keep a vigilant eye out for it. And start looking up the signs of rose rosette. It's kind of like a flower that's kind of, okay, if you watch Star Trek and you saw something come out of the transporter wrong, that's the best way you can describe it. Like twisted, like it's recognizable.
We're trekkers.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's like it came out wrong somehow. Like it's twisted, or it starts to have this really weird looking foliage to it. Right. Then you need to rip out and destroy that whole rose because there's nothing you can treat it with. Nothing you can go back.
Oh wow.
So yeah, it's striking. There's a lot of research going into how we can deal with rose rosette, but yeah, it's striking the heart, and you know, rose lovers everywhere are in fear.
Oh, that looks awful. We're looking at pictures right now because we've never, mm-hmm. we've just never had that.
We've
over
never
here.
Come across.
We
it,
do yeah. actually have black spot on our roses with the moist, cool, mm-hmm.
but only in the high humidity.
But not bad. Yeah.
Homes. Yeah. Yeah. Usually we don't see a lot of it. But
yeah. No, it's ours. Is you get one good month from like mid April to mid May out of your roses, and everything looks gorgeous. Foliage looks gorgeous. They're in bloom, and then black spot hits everything. And they quickly defoliate and, you know, just look awful from the bottom third at least. And you could, of course, do plenty of treatments and sprays. But if you want to garden organically, then you're going to select roses that are more black spot resistant. Yep. And the key to that is resistant. There's no such thing as black spot proof. So yeah. Just try to get, you know, more varieties that are bred for that resistance, and you'll still get plenty of blooms. And I say always the same thing too in the vegetable garden about powdery mildew.
Oh,
yeah. So you can get powdery mildew on your cucumbers, your zucchini, you know, even your zinnia flowers. Nope. You'll still get tons of flowers and fruit. It's just not a pretty plant.
It's just not pretty.
Not at all.
No.
Yeah.
It might slow it down a little bit. Yeah. So there's drawbacks to extra moisture. I have great feeling for anybody going through drought. It's the worst, most demoralizing, you know, horrible situation to deal with drought. But, you know, excess humidity also has its issues too.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It does.
And moisture. So let's move on to plants and maybe some zonal envy and things we can grow that you can't grow and vice versa. I made a tiny list of two things that I think you guys do much better in Washington State than we do here in Washington, D.C.
Cool.
And number one, and this was one of the plants I first fell in love with and had to have in my garden, was fuchsia. So we can do annual fuchsia, you know, beautiful baskets of annual fuchsia can do pretty okay, but perennial fuchsia, Gartenmeister is pretty much the only one they sell here. And that's like barely. I would have still probably taken it to winter it over as a house plant and then bring it back out.
Oh wow. That's you know, we do grow fuchsias, the hardy ones, pretty well here. My mom has a really old fuchsia. It's huge.
Ooh,
beautiful.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Just a beautiful garden.
It's years old too, that thing. It must be at least 10 years old.
And she has, it's not in the shade.
Not at all. It's actually in full sun.
I know. It's amazing.
Right against the house. It gets and the house is white. So it gets that, you know, it gets that reflection of that heat. So it's interesting. It's like, wow. Oh, okay. We just bought an actual hardy fuchsia this year, and we're loving it so far.
Love it. It's beautiful. We're still adding a lot of plants to our garden at this time. We didn't have that yet. But
We have an undeveloped area that we've been calling the back 40 for a while, but it's we live on a city lot, you know, but it's just back, way back, and it's just been undeveloped until right now. So we're still developing that area. It's full of salal, which is a shrub, a native shrub out here. And then just some roadies that went wild and some other plants. So it's fun.
Mm-hmm. And I'm glad you mentioned roadies, Sean, because that was the other one on our list, because we do have native rhododendron in the mid-Atlantic, but they're basically, when I talked about that fall line earlier, only on the left side of that fall line and only at certain elevations do they thrive.
Wow.
And you can have rhododendrons in your garden. And many people do in older suburban and urban neighborhoods, but they're not happy. They're not the same rhododendrons as you see, like if you go to England and see some of their huge rhododendron gardens or in the Pacific Northwest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we feel really lucky that we've got the climate we have and all the trees and, you know, the understory to actually the duff and the soil to actually be able to grow a lot of different kinds. Actually, it's really cool. It's so fun.
Beautiful. The Pacific rhododendron, right? Yeah. That's one that's actually native here, and it's our state flower.
Yep.
So that's kind of fun.
Yeah. So
nice. Yeah, and azaleas do fabulously. They are in the rhododendron family, and azaleas do very well. But it's generally because, you know, thinner wood material more acclimated, and there's even coastal azaleas that are native to certain areas and down into the south that are very heat resistant. But it's the roadies, and paired kind of with them is mountain laurel. I don't know if you have the same kalmia, the native mountain laurel, but that's also something that prefers a bit of elevation and good drainage right along with the rhododendron.
Oh yeah.
Like, we have it up here. I don't know. We're not sure if that's native.
It's Kalmia latifolia, but it grows really well. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. And then the third thing, final one on my list that I was like, ooh, if I could do this as well as they do in the Pacific Northwest, which is moss, because I'm in love with moss, moss lawns. I do kokedama balls. I do little moss terrariums.
Oh, cute.
Oh, wow.
And I just love, and my little moss lawn is like a 3-foot oval, basically, and I have to baby it. I don't think you have to baby your moss.
Oh, it grows everywhere around
so
here.
Much moss.
It'll grow in your grass, even in the full sun. It definitely takes over roofs and, you know, parts of buildings and such.
It's very green and lush.
Yeah, it adds the greenery around here.
it's not something we necessarily want everywhere, but yeah.
We even have moss actually growing. Well, we had it growing right in the canopy of a couple of our azalea plants. Along with the lichen, but it was actually growing up in the canopy of these azalea plants, and it literally grew so much that it was shitting out the rest of the azalea, and it was killing the azalea. It was suffocating it, basically.
Wow.
So we basically, what we really had to do is we had to cut the azalea about halfway, give it a halfway haircut, really prune it hard, and then we transplanted away from it where it was, because we were refurbishing them. Rehabilitating,
way too dense.
But we had to cut all that out because the moss had just literally taken over most of the plant. It was crazy.
Yeah, it really liked its home.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you like moss, come out here.
Yeah. And there are pockets in, you know, certain mountain sides where there's alkaline, limey soils where mountain does very well. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure I have some DC area listeners who are like, I've been trying to get that moss off my back steps for years where they might have a damp area, but in general, it's nothing compared to what you guys can have. There's not going to be that Portland Japanese moss garden here.
Oh,
that's not. Oh, yeah. That's just not going to happen.
Oh no! You know, in a previous job, I had a pesticide license. I did different things for that job as a grounds person, but I had a specific license from the state to treat moss for my employer and for other people that needed it. And the moss around here actually continuously grows in our climate until it reaches the summertime, and then it stops growing. But in the spring and in the winter and the fall, that stuff just grows, and it's so hard to control. There's whole companies that do nothing out here but control moss. I mean, they specialize in it. They, you know, they do lawns and all that, but one of the main things they do is, we'll help you with your moss. We'll get rid of it. I mean, that's their main focus. And it's just like, wow. Yeah. Moss is a problem.
I think they should turn to moss farming and not moss control.
There you go. Yeah. Yeah. There
and, you know, because I can tell you that sheet moss is expensive and most of it is imported and probably, you know, not that ethically sourced, some of it. And there's a moss farmer I know in Georgia, and she does ethically source hers and grows her own. But yeah, most of it that's imported that you're buying, say, at a craft store as sheet moss, you know, I always kind of, you know, use it begrudgingly because that's all that's available sometimes for doing moss crafts. But yeah, if you guys could have some more moss farms and grow sheets.
Yeah.
Yep.
We'll just go get a heavily wooded area and we'll just have a moss farm. That'd be fun.
Yeah, exactly. As slow as moss grows or as fast as it grows. Yeah. So any plants that you're familiar with from the DC area that you envy?
We were trying to think of some, like, our growing zones aren't really that different, but can you think of any, Sean?
Not really. I mean, we know we can definitely grow some of the same plants, but...
What about lavender? Do you know lavender well over there?
No, I wouldn't say well, but enough. There enough that there are some lavender farms being established in the area.
Oh, nice.
So, and I had said earlier about the kind of hilly topography, especially in the countryside. So they definitely have benefited. So There's a couple lavender farms, cut flower farms that are doing hillsides of lavenders and rows and lavenders, and they'll open up. And there's one in Catlett, Virginia, and one right across the Maryland border in Pennsylvania that's been operating for over 20 years.
Wow.
And they have a little lavender festival every year there. So you can do your cut your own, your lavender crafts, but definitely the English varieties of lavender do better in most people's gardens. The clay soil doesn't lend itself well, but if you have a good drainage area, like on a slope or say over a retaining wall, you can do well with lavender. And then of course the new varieties of lavender that are coming out from Lloyd Traven. So like there's Phenomenal that came out a few years ago, and then Sensational is another lavender that's just hitting the market. And those are both winter hardy and a little less susceptible to the rot. So that's what happens when they sit in clay soil too much, then the roots can rot. And that's the only reason they would fail is because of that, is because you would just pull them out one day and the rots are just not, the roots not happy. But
What about flowering cherries? We have a lot of the flowering cherries out here. They're beautiful, but they have there's issues with some diseases and some rots. What about out there?
Not any diseases like that. So obviously DC known for the Tidal Basin Cherry Blossom Festival. And all of the ornamental cherries. I have a weeping hyacinth in my front yard. No problems with that. So we can have occasional like cherry borer issues. And cherries aren't the longest lived trees. So, you know, if you get a good 20, 30 years out of a cherry tree, ornamental cherry, that is, not the edible cherries, then that's good. But, you know, there are some older neighborhoods who they're basically having cherry lined streets and they're known for that. And then they have to replace some of the older trees as they age out. But that's usually not because of disease issues. That's usually more because of old age.
Oh, it sounds beautiful.
Yeah, some of the neighborhoods are a little too popular, they're finding, with the cherry line, you know, because the tidal basin can get super crowded and touristy. So people know about these little pockets and neighborhoods that they can just either drive through or walk through and see all the cherry blossoms there, too.
Oh, that'd be nice. Yeah.
So,
I mean, we grow a lot of Shasta daisies here. I think those are pretty, although, I mean, you probably grow those pretty well over there.
Yeah, they're short-lived blooms for us, unless you do like the chop back and get a little bit of a second flush from them. I would say probably one thing that I hear from people who either move from DC to the Pacific Northwest or vice versa, the big difference they find is on the edible side of the garden, that their tomatoes do much better here in the Mid-Atlantic. So you already obviously hear about famous Jersey tomatoes and the Rutgers tomatoes and stuff that, you know, I think you all do cherry tomatoes just as well.
Cherry tomatoes, beefsteak, Romas, but our window for growing is so short.
It's really short. That's a bummer. I know, it's like, and it's different on the two sides of this of our state too. I mean,
So this is the interesting thing. Everybody thinks, you know, and it does. It rains, you know, it rains quite a good amount here on the west side of the state, but on the east side of the state, it's interesting. There's high desert areas. There's Midwest like areas, and they have over 300 days of sunshine guaranteed on the state. Yeah, guaranteed every year. And it's so different on the other side. It's drier, it's windier, it's higher in elevation, but it's just they have a lot more opportunity to grow a lot of tomatoes and other crops on the other side.
That's where more of like the fruit tree orchards and that sort of thing are located.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and I think that in Washington State, you're better at growing the brassicas, like Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower type things. Whereas for us, it's a super short shoulder season in the early spring and fall. And it's really hard to get Brussels sprouts in a short shoulder season because it goes from super hot, still in the 90s through September, And then you'll have 80s to 70s in October, and then you'll have a hard freeze maybe come in November, wow. December. So that could zap it at a certain point. But that does give us a long season for our heirloom tomatoes. So you can get those really big, nice, old, like, heirlooms and the Amish paste tomatoes. So,
Yeah. We definitely grow those. I know we're like, oh,
you're making us hungry.
Yum. So, yeah, BLTs for a long time. And that was always, yeah. And then I think the other edible I was thinking about was like okra and some of the tropicals that love our summers here. Mm. So, you know, tobacco. Plantations were a backbone of the Mid-Atlantic economy, obviously during the colonial times and up through the 1800s. And then they bought out a lot of tobacco farms in the last a couple of decades with some of the settlements from the cigarette companies. So they've switched over to corn and soybean, a lot of those farmers.
Oh, good. Yeah. Nice.
So, yeah, I'm like, I don't ever think I've ever heard of tobacco being grown in the Pacific Northwest. Maybe it can.
That I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it might be few and far between, but nothing.
Yeah, because it needs hot, and then it also needs to be cured. So you have tobacco barns. You'll see abandoned tobacco barns where you're just laying the leaves in bundles for curing. So a lot of them will be converted to sheds or something else or use. And one farmer I saw switched to garlic fields from his tobacco.
Oh, wow.
And so you could use the same curing barn. I was like, yeah, because you have to cure garlic too and hang it up in the rafters. So, and have just these open kind of open weave walls for the air to go through. You're not going to put animals or any type of equipment into a tobacco farm in a barn. I mean,
that's interesting. I didn't think
Not tobacco. You know, we do a lot of bulbs out here though. A lot of bulbs.
A lot of bulb companies.
Yeah, there's a lot of tulips and a lot of daffodils. Actually, locally, there's the Tacoma Tulip Festival.
Yeah.
And then up north, there's the tulip fields up in Skagit Valley, about 2 hours away from us north. And actually, it must have been, I think it was late 1800s, early 1900s, a whole bunch of bulb farmers and breeders from the East Coast, but also from Europe, came out this way, and they found out that the climate out here, but especially up north of us in Skagit Valley, was perfect for all different kinds of bulbs. So they brought their companies out, and they started doing all these breeding programs of all these different bulbs to acclimatize them here and to start growing them and supply this part of the nation. It was really good.
Irises
really cool.
And daffodils, tulips.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Nice.
Yeah.
Because we have Brent and Becky bulbs in Tidewater, Virginia.
Oh, yeah, Brent and Becky, yay!
Yay. And they're in Tidewater, Virginia, which is very, very sandy soil and, like, literally Tidewater.
Oh, wow.
So just above Williamsburg, Virginia. So in that inlet there. So they're getting, you know, very similar conditions to the Netherlands, where you get flooded fields and then it dries out. So, and that's why they had picked that area. And that's known, of course, for their big daffodil festival every spring. Other than that, I've seen some people doing tulip fields as cut flower farms as kind of like destination family type things, like the same way you would do a cornfield planted in a maize sunflower fields for tourism, but not definitely for breeding and selling of the bulbs. So that's a little bit different.
Yeah.
That's fun.
Well, in the springtime too, I think it's the whole month of April, there's the Tulip Festival up there, and it's between actually two or three companies, and they literally open up their fields for everybody
Hundreds
to come and walk through, and you can just take pictures. It's almost like a fair. It's amazing, and it's just acres and acres of just nothing but different colors of tulips. Yeah.
And do they winter over the tulips, or do you in your garden, or do you treat them as annuals?
We winter over,
yeah.
Yeah, we can leave them in the ground, which is so nice.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Yeah. I do in my own garden, same thing with cannas and some of the other, like, gladiolas and tender bulbs can winter over fine here. And that's how we know climate change is coming, because 15 years ago, I could not have said that I overwinter my cannas by leaving them in the ground.
Yeah, wow. I thought they're zone 8 and above, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Wow.
Yep. So, and those, but yeah, a lot of the local public gardens and other places will treat tulips as annual. Because if you irrigate during the winter and the summer, then the bulbs are just going to rot there in the clay soils. And it's not because of the cold hardiness, because they can obviously take colder climates. It's because of irrigation, and they want to put annual beds in the same place, of course, that they have the tulip displays in springtime.
Oh, okay. Or if the squirrels don't get them here, I guess we have a bad squirrel,
Slugs and squirrels, Kathy.
I know.
And, and deer. That's the main problem with tulips here is people just have the deer come and just mow down a whole line of them.
Because
they're edible for them, just like they're edible for us, too.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Heartbreaking.
Right, well, This has been fantastic to compare and contrast the two different Washingtons, so we can visit each other and enjoy each other's garden. And we do share so much of the same plant palette, of course.
I know, I didn't realize that.
It's great.
Yeah, and usually even with the native plants, almost always there will be a West Coast and an East Coast version of the same thing. So same like with our red buds, you know, we'll have the Eastern, the Canadian strain of redbud here, and you might have a Western redbud, and they're so similar but slightly different.
Yep, and the cedars, Eastern red cedar, Western red cedar. Yep.
I think even service berries I was looking at, I was like, you guys have slightly different service berries, but still recognizable and pretty much the same. So a lot can be transplanted and shared. And then, of course, you have a lot of plant breeders and sellers and the bulb companies you mentioned selling to local gardeners here on the East Coast and vice versa. And of course, we love the miniature dwarf conifers from Isley and others in the Pacific Northwest, which were like, oh, if we could only have more of those in our garden. So those are always fun to add. Any last thoughts comparing and contrasting?
No, it's just been great to just overall think about this and talk about it. It is fun, and we would look forward to doing it again.
You know, I love learning about the topography in your area and how that's just created so many differences, and that was really interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, whenever I go to a different region for garden tours or anything, like with the Garden Communicators Association, GardenCom, it's always great to hear from the local residents the differences in the soils and the differences in the topography and that sort of thing, because it does affect the plant palette so much.
That's so fun to learn about. I know, I love that.
Sean and Allison, how can our listeners get in touch with you, follow your podcast, watch your videos on YouTube?
Yeah, basically what you described. We have a channel on YouTube, a Spoken Garden channel, and we teach beginners how to care for their plants and flowers, ornamental flowers and plants. And they can find us on most of the social media. And we're most active probably on Instagram and Twitter. We are on Facebook. So
At Spoken Garden, on all those platforms. You can find us on most of the podcast platforms under Spoken Garden. We should be out there. If you want to email us, Sean and Allison, all one word, @spokengarden.com.
Great. Thank you so much, Sean and Allison.
Yeah, thank you.
This has been really fun.
Yeah, it's been fun.
Joe Pieweed Plant Profile. Joe Pieweed, Eupatorium purpureum, is a perennial plant that blooms in midsummer through autumn. It is native to the eastern United States and is hardy to zones 4 through 8. Spotted Joe Pieweed, Eupatorium maculatum, and hollow Joe Pieweed, Eupatorium fistulosum, are very similar in looks and growth habits. Joe Pieweed prefers full to part sun, light conditions, and evenly moist soils. It is both deer and rabbit resistant. It also tolerates clay soil and road salt spray well. The only maintenance it needs is to cut it back to the ground in early spring. It's a great addition to any pollinator garden, as it's a real magnet for attracting both bees and butterflies. Joe Pieweed grows to 6 feet tall and can lean over. It's best to situate it at the back of the border where other plants can support it. You can also pinch back the plant in late spring so that it stays shorter and creates more flowering branches. Gateway is a popular cultivar that is widely available for home gardeners. There are also shorter varieties for sale that do not grow as tall as these straight species. These include Little Joe, Red Dwarf, and Baby Joe. Joe Pye Weed, you can grow that. What's new in the garden this week? Well, it's been a hot one, but I still managed to put together a few entries for the Montgomery County Agricultural Fair. We'll see if any of them are ribbon worthy. In the local gardening world, there's a few events I want to draw your attention to. One is the native plant sale at Chesapeake Natives, and that's taking place on August 29th. And the other is the 6th annual Pawpaw Fest at Long Creek Homestead in Frederick, Maryland on September 18th. And that is put on by friend of the show, Michael Judd. I urge you to go back and listen to our episode last year where we talked to Michael all about pawpaw growing, and give that a listen and then get over to that Pawpaw Festival. The next event I want to highlight can be attended by anybody in the world, and this is a virtual water gardening conference put on by the International Water Gardening Society. You can register at iwgs.org. It takes place August 21st and 22nd. They are limited to the first 500 registrants, so get your registration in soon. And that features water tours, talks of water gardens, and beautiful water plants. I think water lilies and lotus are some of the most beautiful flowers that exist on this planet, so I hope you check that out. And speaking of beautiful flowers, in my own home garden this week, I'm enjoying some double blooms on my cosmos and a beautiful purple trumpet datura, just stunning right now with its double flowers opening up. It is enjoying this tropical heat and humidity. I'm kind of wilting. I don't know about the rest of you. I'm looking forward to some cool temperatures next week. Happy gardening! Thank you for listening to Garden DC. You can become a listener supporter for as little as 99 cents a month by going to anchor.fm/gardendc/support. Another way to support this podcast is to subscribe to our monthly digital publication, Washington Gardener Magazine. To do so, go to washingtongardener.com. Thank you. You can find Washington Gardener online at washingtongardener.com, on Twitter at WDCGardener, on Instagram at WDCGardener, and on Facebook.com at Washington Gardener Magazine.